from studios underwritten in part by Sputnik Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. I'm back from Portland. My brother-in-law is doing well. Louise is spending the week out there. It's going to be an interesting time. There's so much in the news. The shootings of the police officers over the weekend. Michael Smith, Lauren Ahrens, Brent Thompson, Patrick Zamaripa, and Michael Kroll. Not to mention, you know, the shootings that preceded those. There's a piece in the New York Times today that really disturbs me. You know, they say, what's the old saying? There are lies, damn lies, and then there's statistics. And the article is about some research that a researcher did on police officers' interactions with black people. And interestingly, the fellow who's doing the research, Mr. Fryer, is African-American himself. In fact, he's the youngest African-American to receive tenure at Harvard. I should call him Dr. Fryer. Roland G. Fryer did the study. And what he found was that police officers are more, and by the way, this is like, you know, at the top of Drudge, right? Of course. Police officers are more likely to use their hands with blacks than with whites in similar situations. They're more likely to push black people into the wall than white people. They're more likely to use handcuffs. They're more likely to draw their weapons. They're more likely to push people to the ground. They're more likely to point their weapons, and they're more likely to use the pepper spray or baton by percentages ranging from 17 to 25% more likely. But when it came to shooting people dead, the police officers were just as likely to kill white people as black people, according to this study in the New York Times. That's published in the New York Times. Or the study isn't published in the New York Times, but an article about the study by Kwok Trung Bui and Amanda Cox is published in the New York Times. And what troubles me about this is that this fellow really just looked at, the study examined more than 1,000 shootings in 10 major police departments in Texas, Florida, and California. The guy's a professor of economics at Harvard. And I applaud his effort to try to come up with some reasonable data here to find out what's going on. But Ferguson is not a major police department. As one of the comments in the New York Times noted today, Baton Rouge is not a major police department. Cleveland is not a major police department. St. Anthony's PD in Minnesota is not a major police department. So why were we not able, and you would expect major police departments, with arguably the exceptions of Chicago and New York, it seems, to have, you know, really good professional, higher professional standards for their officers than suburban police departments that might just be hiring at you know, low wages, and they're having to basically harass the poor and particularly minority people in their communities in order to pay for their existence. I mean, Ferguson, case in point. So why was he not able to look at all police departments in the United States or all shootings by police in the United States? I'm guessing the reason has something to do with Congressman Jay Dickey and his efforts back in 1996 on behalf of the National Rifle Association. Efforts, by the way, that he has since repudiated. Back, Walter Hickey wrote this piece for Business Insider back in January of 2013. This is not new. And again, this is 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago. More than 100 scientists from universities in the United States lobbied Vice President Joe Biden, asking him to allow the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to once again fund research into the public health impact of guns. The CDC is not, Walter Hickey wrote, is not allowed to pursue many kinds of gun research due to the lobbying strength of the National Rifle Association. And here's the backstory to this. He says, prior to 1996, the CDC conducted research into the causes of firearm-related deaths. Now, this isn't specific to police. This is just guns in general. After a series of articles finding that increased prevalence of guns led to increased incidents of gun violence, gee, what a surprise, Republicans sought to remove all federal funding for research into gun deaths. There's that Republican thing again. In 1996, Republican Representative Jay Dickey removed $2.6 million from the CDC budget, the precise amount the CDC spent on gun research the previous year, 1995. The current law now reads, none of the funds made available for injury prevention and control at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention may be used to advocate or promote gun control. So nobody's doing the research because they all know that the results of the research are going to show more guns, more deaths, which is, quote, promoting gun control. So, you know, respectfully, I think this study that's on the front page of the New York Times and that is being waved high to the heavens on right-wing sites all over the internet. Not surprisingly, given this situation, is a classic case of garbage in, garbage out. If your statistics, it's suffering from terrible sample bias. If you're only looking at 10 major police departments, you're not going to find out what's going on in small police departments. You're not going to find out what's going on in suburban police departments. In fact, it seems that some of the biggest problems that we've had with police shootings of minorities have been in the suburban police departments around big cities, particularly in suburban police departments where you've got a fairly substantial white population and an African-American population. And the police seem to see their job as protecting the white people from the black people. So, this, as a very straightforward starting point. But anyway, it's anything goes summer, and anything you want to talk about is fine. But I wanted to start with that. I just want to knock that down before it goes any farther, because this thing is going to go totally viral. Right, all the right-wing sites are pushing it. Fox is all over it. Like I said, it's at the top of Drudge. Police not more likely to kill black people than white people. Meanwhile, the mayor of Dallas, Mike Rawlings, who was standing next to the governor, Greg Abbott, a photographer over at Democratic Underground, posts this. Says, Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings stood next to Texas Governor Greg Abbott and dropped an extremely uncomfortable reality check. Open carry, the movement pushed with near fanatical obsession by Republicans in Texas, not only did nothing to help stop the mass shooting of police officers in Dallas, but it actually made the situation far worse. The police, they were being shot at. They didn't know from where. And here's a whole bunch of white guys wearing camouflage and bulletproof vests and carrying AR-15s. And you're being shot at. And you're a police officer. What do you do? What do you think? It's amazing to me that more of those people that none of those people got shot themselves. But in any case, that's a starting point. Philando Castile, by the way, stopped by the police 52 times. Driving while black. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Quarter after, 15 minutes past the hour. Rich, watching Free Speech TV in Greenwood, Indiana. Hey, Rich, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Glad to see you back in hale and hearty.
Thank you.
I wanted to bring attention to something that is being occurring, but just sort of set aside, and that is that what has been achieved at the platform committee's efforts in Florida, Democratic Platform Committee, has just sort of trickled in as moments of reporting. But over the weekend, as it had already happened, it was getting short shrift. And that level of reporting was the crawl on CNN for me. It was 1:30 in the afternoon on Saturday, and had the TV on as just on, and I look to the crawl, and there I see $15 an hour, and I say, wait a minute, that's important. And so I go over to the TV and I start reading the crawl, and it's a big deal.
Yeah,
I mean, the things that Bernie has held out for, the things that Bernie's campaign was all about, they are being permitted into the big tent, which is where we want them. And you know, if Hillary's going to be the one in front of the parade leading it, great, you know, but we've got this list of things that are so important that were brought attention to by Senator Sanders and garnered him all of this support, and now all of that support needs to be very purposefully embraced, and we need a groundswell that results in a landslide victory for a Democratic candidate for president that extinguishes all that has been, all the brush fires that have been purposefully set by the GOP and Trump, and it needs to just be squashed, eradicated. And our president needs to have a mandate to say what has been shall not be, and we got a future to look to, and we're going to go forward with it. And that stuff is not American values.
Yeah, I don't disagree. The at least on with everything you said, or at least with much of what you said, there are. I mean, you know, for example, the platform committee said no, we're not going to reject the TPP. But they did say we are going to write language in saying that we think trade agreements should be worker friendly. I you know, personally, I think those are weasel words, but who knows? They said we're not going to accept the proposal that was put forward by, I think, Wendell Potter or one of his associates that healthcare is a right, not a privilege.
Yeah.
They said we're not going to do that. And
hey, let's go back to ACT UP. You know, healthcare is a right. Healthcare is a right.
No, but not according to the Democratic National Committee, and not according to the platform. They voted that down. Healthcare is not it will not be a right. But what they did vote for was adding a public option to Obamacare, which, frankly, you know, I think is the beginning of, you know, it cracks open the door in a big way if it were to be done. It cracks open the door in a big way to single payer health insurance, because pretty much everybody will buy the public option. So there's a lot of compromise going on there. I've been waiting for a good summary, and I've not been able to find it. I think that the Democratic National Convention's platform committee meeting in Orlando yesterday is probably the most underreported story in America right now. Had it been Republicans, they would have been all over it. But Rich, excellent points all. Thank you for the call. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. There's another thing here that I wanted to get into. I'm going to wait for the second hour to get into this, and that has to do with addiction and culture and violence, and you know, I think I found something that kind of pulls a lot of these things together, but I'll share that with you the next hour. President Obama spoke to some of these issues. This clip number one, Danielle, this is President Obama saying that the shootings, this was a speech he gave, I believe, on Thursday. So this was before the police were shot. And he was speaking of the shootings by police of black men who are not apparently representing an immediate threat to the police. He said that they are a symptom of a larger issue. Here he is.
All of us as Americans should be troubled by these shootings. because these are not isolated incidents. They're symptomatic of a broader set of racial disparities that exist in our criminal justice system.
And then he lays out exactly what those racial disparities are and how they play out. And see, his statistics somewhat, at least in one point, somewhat conflict with this article in today's New York Times that I started out ranting about. But anyhow, here's the president.
I just want to give people a few statistics to try to put in context why emotions are so raw around these issues. According to various studies, not just one, but a wide range of studies that have been carried out over a number of years, African Americans are 30% more likely than whites to be pulled over. After being pulled over, African Americans and Hispanics are 3 times more likely to be searched. Last year, African Americans were shot by police at more than twice the rate of whites. African Americans are arrested at twice the rate of whites. African American defendants are 75% more likely to be charged with offenses carrying mandatory minimums. They receive sentences that are almost 10% longer than comparable whites arrested for the same crime. So that if you add it all up, the African American and Hispanic population, who make up only 30% of the general population, make up more than half of the incarcerated population.
So we've got a problem. And, you know, part of that is just good old-fashioned racism and the structural racism. And part of this is this cultural issue that I want to get into in the second hour. But let's work through this first. And we've not, I mean, this isn't the first time, right, that we've had this conversation. Bobby Kennedy tried to start this conversation. And this is Bobby Kennedy. This is after the death of Martin Luther King back in, what was it, 1967, as I recall? 68? It was 68 that he died, that's right. Here is Bobby Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, speaking on racial justice after the death of Martin Luther King.
Is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black. We can do well in this country. We will have difficult times. We've had difficult times in the past, but we will have difficult times in the future. It is not the end of violence. It is not the end of lawlessness, and it's not the end of disorder.
Yeah. So, no, it's not. It's not the end of violence. It's not the end of disorder. And so, anyway. Horacio in San Diego, California. You're on the air.
Good morning, Tom.
Can you take me off speakerphone, please?
Huh?
Can you take me off speakerphone, please? It sounds like you're calling from the bottom of a well.
I'm sorry. Okay, Tom, last month we celebrated Stonewall, right?
Yeah.
So if the homosexuals and the transgenders can get into a fight with the New York Police Department and make them stop getting murdered, getting robbed, getting a false imprisonment, why can't the minorities have a guy like that? How come we can't have a stand like that?
You know, I would bet you, Horacio, that 95% of the people at Stonewall were white.
Yes. Okay. So, but they finally got tired. Their mayors wasn't helping them.
My point is that for the gay rights movement, And this is not to diminish the gay rights movement. I mean, you know, gay people have been the victims of violence and hatred and just unspeakable terror for millennia. But the gay rights movement at least had that small advantage of white privilege, at least to a large extent.
Okay, but the point was about those good cops that everybody's talking about.
Right.
Finally, the gays got tired of being murdered.
Right.
You know, just like us, Tom. I went around last Friday because I didn't feel sorry for the cops at all, and I thought I was a bad human being. But then I started talking to other minorities, and guess what? None of them felt bad about the cops. And guess what we had in common, Tom? We all had our own cop stories.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, and this gentleman that, yes, in society, he was a criminal and he did bad. But in poetic justice, in my view, he is a hero.
Who is this he you're talking about?
Oh, the guy that shot the cops.
Horacio, are you honest to God? He is not. This guy is no hero. He's. Give me a break. I mean, that is the most obscene thing that I have. I think I've heard in years. He's a killer. And we trained him. Our military trained him. He's a killer. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
I can't believe that. We'll be back. Graham. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's, as I said, anything goes summer. So, although, you know, in this hour, I pretty much started out with the shootings of everybody from Philando Castile to these Dallas police officers. Kenyatta in Redlands, California. Hey, Kenyatta, what's on, and what's on your mind?
Tom, I want to tell you first, I appreciate you. Taking a call from me in pretty short period of time, a second call, and I wanted to talk to you about Anglo-cognitive dissonance a little bit more. We spoke on that a few days ago, and this caller that you just had, Horacio, and I could tell that you were incensed by what he said, and I certainly wouldn't have made such a statement, but I do want to say to you, Tom, that this type of reaction that you had is really what it translates to me as, and mind you, I'm a former police officer, is a denial of our experiences as black people. On Friday, you said that one caller called in and said that basically they were concerned about now a tit for tat because these officers were attacked, and now that, you know, this may spiral into, you know, this kind of a tit for tat kind of situation, and you, and which is a legitimate concern, and you,
right.
you kind of concurred with that. And then you followed up with, you know, thanks to that, you know, and I'm paraphrasing, you referred to the shooter as being an idiot. Now, I want to tell you something, Tom. When you, as a black person, are watching your children, your women, your fathers constantly, how many times have you and I talked about this in the last year and a half? How long is that list? At some point, you get tired, Tom. They're killing us anyway.
Yeah.
They're killing us anyway, and like I said, I think that Horacio was
Kenyatta. If I can just share with you where I'm coming from on this, I've been through this conversation before outside the realm of race, and this was in 1967, 68, 69 when I was in SDS, and it was about the war, and our government, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, our government was trying to kill us. We being, you know, teenagers, young
right.
people of all races, frankly, although
my father was there. Tom.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I was hanging out with virtually all of SDS was white at that point, at least at Michigan State University. There were black SDS, not so many, but in any case, it's mostly white. But the discussion that we had was they are killing us, right? Our government and we all knew people who had died in Vietnam, and we all knew people who had come back from Vietnam badly maimed and wounded. And it was wrong. And we all knew that it was a lie. And we all knew that we were dying for no good reason. And there was a group within our group that split off and said, okay, screw this. We're going to fight back. We're going to take on the power structure that is using violence against us with violence. And that group became the Weathermen. And it did not turn out well. And what I'm saying, and you know, again, it had nothing to do with race, but I think it was the, you know, I know those, or I knew those people, or at least I knew a couple of them, and their argument was, I mean, it's hard to deny. Yes, you know, they're trying to kill us, right? And yes, they lied to us. And yes, it's unfair. And yes, it's wrong. And yes, it's institutional and murder, essentially. But responding to violence with violence is not the answer. And that's why I called that guy an idiot. And that's why I would call anybody who responds to violence with violence an idiot. I'm with Martin Luther King on this thing. I'm with Jesus on this thing.
I appreciate that, Tom. But, you know, and again, I'm going to, because I kind of have a different, you know, I mean, I've viewed this from both sides of the fence. And there's a soft abuse that occurs with police officers that doesn't, that isn't newsworthy. It doesn't result in a shooting, being verbally disrespected, being called names, being handled. You spoke at the top of your show about the different tactics that are used versus a white suspect versus a black suspect.
Sure.
This has gone on continually. And when, so what most white people say, well, go file a complaint. Go file a complaint, that the file a lawsuit. Do you know that very
good luck few with that
will take police abuse cases, and those that do want a $20,000 or $30,000 retainer? If you had $20,000 or $30,000 to retain an attorney, you probably wouldn't have been in a situation to be abused by the police in the first place.
Right. But none of that justifies
criminalistic fact. The youngest person ever executed in the United States was a 14-year-old black boy. The only time an aerial bomb was dropped in the United States in the history of this country was on the MOVE headquarters in Philadelphia. And now we have a robot going in and blowing up this dude, black guy.
Yeah. Well, first of all, Kenyatta, I want to be very, very clear and I hope that you are not even dancing toward the edge of saying that the sniper's actions were justified.
No.
Okay.
What I'm saying is that Debbie didn't do Dallas. Despair did Dallas. What I'm saying to you, I'm going to throw that back at you, Tom. I'm asking you, what is the solution?
Well, that's I want to get into that in more detail in the next hour, but I think the solution is we've got to fix our society. We've got a broken society, a broken culture, and part of that is our police culture, and part of that is institutional racism, and part of that is poverty, and part of that, I mean, there's all these different pieces, and a lot of it is being driven by, you know, explicitly racist policies over the years. A lot of it's being driven by austerity policies that are hitting white people, too. A lot of it's being driven. I mean, there's just a whole bunch of different things here. This is, if there was a simple answer, somebody would have come up with it a long time ago and said, here.
God.
You know?
Yeah.
And Kenyatta, by the way, you said, you know, they drove the robot with the bomb in and blew the guy up, and he was a black guy, and it was the first time we've ever used a bomb domestically. And I've read the articles about that, and I've read the commentaries on both sides of it. And I just ask you, if he had been taken out by a sniper, now he was trained as a sniper by our military and deployed to Afghanistan. So as a sniper, he knew how to avoid getting shot. But if he wasn't as well trained as he was and he'd been taken out by a sniper instead of a bomb, what would the difference be?
Oh, there is no difference. And as far as the modality of how he was taken out, I could get less than a flying damn. That's not the point. The point is that these are first in our history. The dropping of the bomb from a helicopter on the MOVE headquarters was the first and only time that's happened in this country.
Yeah.
The youngest person to be executed was a young black boy, 14 years old. That's all I'm talking
about.
Well,
there's actually a large number of people who would say, no, that's not altogether the case. If you look at what happened in Waco, Texas, a whole bunch of white people died because, you know, a tank with a flamethrower attached to the front of it went into the side of a building.
That's a three-legged dog.
I understand. I know it's a lousy example, but it's like, you know, this... The thing that I think you and I both have to be careful of is policy making or policy suggestion by anecdote. We don't need these individual anecdotes to say that we've got a problem. The statistics are clear. The president laid them out. I mean, you know, I played that clip in the last half hour ago.
Well, listen, I wanted to say this to you real quick because I know I'm running out of time. I'm very concerned. All of that notwithstanding, about the Trump effect here.
Mm.
Trump has run a campaign on racial division and bigotry, and something like what took place in Dallas almost ensures even more so his presidency, and I think that's the real tragedy here.
Yeah. Well, I would expand on that. I don't know that it necessarily ensures his presidency, but I can tell you that right now, you know, in doing prep for this show, and I not only read left-wing websites, I read right-wing websites, figure out what's going on. And the right-wing websites are all over this.
Yeah.
You know, it's just they're just like all over it. And, you know, Drudge and InfoWars in particular, it's not, as somebody said to me that, you know, hey, they're trying to gin up a race war. From what I read, no, they're asserting that there's already one going on and that it's being conducted by African-Americans against white people. And if you're white, you better look out and you better run. And you better buy a gun. And you better get ready because the race war is here. And it's all, you know, it's so Turner's diary. I mean, it just blew my mind. So
can I leave you with one quote?
Certainly.
And I know you probably know who this is. Within 20 years, we can peacefully colonize under conditions in which he can rise to the full measure of manhood. This he can never. We can never attain the ideal union our fathers dreamed, with millions of an alien inferior race among us, whose assimilation is neither possible nor desirable. That man was Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah. Yeah, that was Abraham Lincoln before the Civil War.
Okay, so this problem that we're
Lincoln, I mean, you know, this is the complex history of America, Kenyatta. Lincoln ran as a segregationist first,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, before the Emancipation Proclamation, and you could argue, and many people have, that the Emancipation Proclamation was a cynical political ploy, but mm-hmm. you know, the effect was, you know, desirable, and I think in his later years, Lincoln became more enlightened, or, you know, or not. I don't know. I mean,
I concur. And you know what? Unfortunately, just like that brilliant gentleman that you played a clip from, Robert F. Kennedy, Abraham Lincoln, and his brother, John F. Kennedy, RFK's brother, guess what happened to them for trying to do the right thing?
Yeah. Yeah. And it wasn't just the right thing with regard to race, but race was a large part of it, particularly
right.
with Bobby Kennedy and Abraham Lincoln. And yeah. Excellent points all. Kenyatta, thanks for the call. Always nice to hear from you. It's 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Anything goes summer here on the Tom Hartman program. We'll be back with more of your calls right after this. And welcome back, 15 minutes before the hour. And let's see here. Alan in Beaumont, Texas. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
I want to make a couple of quick observations. First of all, just to make the point, you know, like if anybody doubts that there's unequal justice in this country, you know, speaking to you as a black man, let's say as a black man growing up, you know, I'm as aware of crime as anybody else. And as a black man, you always knew that, let's say, for instance, if you go out and commit murder, if you committed a murder and the person was white, you knew that you were pretty much guaranteed to either get a long sentence or a life sentence, as opposed to, say, killing another black man.
Right, or a death sentence, yeah.
And so if anybody doubts that there's unequal justice, even when it comes to police, and I'm not saying that these people shouldn't have been charged, but the two black cops in New Orleans that, you know, inadvertently killed, you know, the suspect was white. He had his son in the car with him, and they were shooting at him, but they ended up killing his son. Within 72 hours, those police were arrested.
When was this?
I think it happened sometime last year, maybe.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it definitely happened.
Yeah, no, I remember the event. I don't remember the details, and I just wanted to make sure it wasn't some new thing that, you know.
So as far as justice is concerned, it's always been the color of the victim and the color of the perpetrator, you know, as far
sure.
as who's more likely to get justice in those situations.
Right.
Now, the other point I wanted to make was this, you know, by this, you know, based upon the events of last week and the last few years, everybody's wondering, well, you know, what's the answer? To me, our biggest problem in America, and Lord knows we have many, but our biggest problem is an allegiance problem. You know, and I'm not even going to say race because I know there's no such thing as racist, but people have allegiance to their color first, or they have allegiance to their religion first, or they have allegiance to their socioeconomic status first. If everyone would be more committed, if their first obligation in their life was to doing right, then that would go a long way towards eliminating a lot of the problems that we have.
You make a really brilliant point, Alan, and that is that it is human nature to kind of circle the wagons on behalf of your own. And this comes out of our need to protect family. I mean, I'm sure it's wired into our DNA. And then family expands to community, expands to clan, expands historically in other societies to tribe, but in our society to community, to state, to nation. And so if we could supersede, if we could make the larger commitment a commitment to the overall society. What's good for all of us as Americans? And have a serious conversation about, you know, how do we make sure that everybody, regardless of color or race, regardless of race or socioeconomic status or regionality or whatever, has, you know, access to health care, has a policing that is not unreasonable, has some relative certainty, safety in terms of housing and employment and reasonable employment, then we take a first step. Alan, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And Rashad Robinson is with us. He's the executive director of Color of Change, website colorofchange.org. You can tweet him at Rashad Robinson. And Rashad, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a while. I'm wondering, first of all, what your thoughts are and what Color of Change, what your position is on what's been going on the last couple of weeks here.
Well, I mean, I think that we're seeing the ongoing visibility of what's been happening in communities for years and deeper understanding and public awareness about the challenges in our criminal justice system. And hopefully what we're seeing is an opportunity and a movement for change. But only if we translate the presence of these issues, the awareness of these issues, into the type of power that changes the rules.
Mm-hmm. What are the rules that need to be changed?
I mean, I think the rules that actually need to change is we need a new incentive structure around accountability for police departments around this country. Right now, we don't have accountability when police officers harm or hurt or put someone in harm's way. And, you know, we have some really common sense things that we think that the federal government should be doing, that we're going to be moving our membership around besides the work to sort of get justice. In these two cases, which is always what we try to do in these cases of getting the Department of Justice and other folks involved, we actually have to do some work around changing the incentive structures, the federal funds that go to local police departments. And when local police departments don't do their job, to hold back that federal fund. You know, over the last 5 years, the Baton Rouge Police Department has gotten over $3 million of federal funds, even while being under investigation, not once, but twice, by the Department of Justice Civil Rights Department. If we're not actually changing the incentive structures, creating consequences for departments that don't actually put in common sense measures, put in consequences for the leadership, then we actually will continue to get the same results. And we'll be here 5 years, 10 years, 15 years from now, with the same results that we've been seeing in communities, where some people are treated by law enforcement and protected by law enforcement in a fair way, and others are treated like enemy combatants in their own communities.
Yeah, I totally agree. And in fact, I would argue that right now we have a perverse incentive, a reverse incentive, and that is that the hyper-militarization of our police departments, all this transfer of military equipment from the military and now directly from defense contractors via the federal government to local police departments, has caused them, as they become more and more hyper-militarized, to withdraw essentially from community policing, to develop more of a bunker mentality And you know, the army's job is to kill people and blow things up. The police department's mission is completely different, and they frankly, in my opinion, should have different tools. And so, a change in direction would be a very, very welcome thing. There's also, though, Rashad, there's also this larger issue of you know, why is it, and what do we do about the fact that the average white family in America has around $80,000 in net worth, and the average black family in America has around $5,000 in net worth, that our schools, you know, are not particularly in minority communities. And I would say in large part because we fund them with property taxes, which is crazy, not to mention the problems of, you know, this privatized school movement. That schools are underperforming, et cetera. You know, what do we do about these larger social issues?
Well, I mean, I think that in order to make Black Lives Matter, this is just simply not a movement around police accountability. This is a movement around housing and education and the economy and so many other things that when you add them up holistically, create a new opportunity and a new incentive structure that allows people to actually flourish in our country. And right now we have all sorts of barriers that limit people's full participation, you know, full opportunity in our society, and creates an incentive structure that allows the criminal justice system to continue to grow, that allows the profiteers of the system, whether they are profiteering financially or profiteering from career incentives, whether it's the prison industrial complex, district attorneys, politicians, corporations. And so we do have to attack this problem and deal with this problem in a holistic way. But right now on the table is, I think, a real opportunity to do some real reform around our criminal justice system, our broken criminal justice system with its broken incentive structures. And we need to do that, and we also have to recognize that that is one of the many problems that we have to deal with, to change an incentive structure in this country that allows some people to flourish while holding other people back.
Right. Specifics on how we outside of the police, you know, we've discussed the police incentive, thoughts on housing, education, the job opportunities?
Well, I mean, I do think that, you know, we continue to see these opportunities that slip us by, whether it was, you know, the big infrastructure investment that we were hoping to get after the financial crash when we were trying to get the new investments. These opportunities, I do think, over the next, you know, 4 and 8 years, as we head in this election cycle and we really push our politicians to think about infrastructure investment that will create real jobs in real communities, as we think about the type of regulations and new incentive structures we need on Wall Street and corporations to, you know, create a new way of business so that they are no longer, you know, able to extract the type of resources they were able to extract in the housing market, but also some real investments in Black communities, in communities of color. These are the many things that, you know, at Color of Change, we've been fighting for and pushing for, while also fighting for common sense reform, recognizing that reform in so many ways only gets us back to a square one while communities have been damaged and held back for so many years. So in some ways, that's not going to fully change the system. On the education front, you know, we've spent decades divesting from public education and actually going back to a really perverse, segregated public education system. Most people aren't aware that 1980 was actually the height of school integration in this country. And since then, we have gone backwards. And as we've gone backwards, the pulling of resources from public education has sort of followed that trend.
Right. It's been devastating. Rashad, I'm sorry, the clock is hitting us. Hang on just a sec. Oh, we're out of time.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.